I'm back. Hi, how are you? I've missed talking to you through this podcast. Oh boy, this has been a long break. Okay, gird your loins, because this is going to be one big intro. At the end of February this year, I was feeling overwhelmed and decided to take some mental health leave. Then COVID lockdowns happened, anti-racism protests happened, and the whole world was thrown into chaos. Some bad chaos, but some necessary and good chaos. During this time, everybody's nerves were fried. And the last thing I wanted to do was make a podcast about millennials' problems, am I right? But things are evening out slowly. You know, things are coming back to a better place. And I'm recharged, so let's do this! But just a little differently. In the future, there is a possibility that you'll hear some advertising on this podcast. I've done my best to painstakingly filter ad categories so that any ads that might play align with my personal values. I don't have all the information about this as yet, but when I do, I will tell you. But just keep in mind, you may hear some ads on this podcast in the future. The other thing is, from now onwards, episodes will be fortnightly. This seems to be a sustainable schedule for me at present. There are a few other little changes coming up, but I will tell you more when I can. Okay, one more thing. With so much recent talk of structural racism and white supremacy, we here in Australia must not forget that the worst race-related discrimination historically was and currently is committed against Indigenous Australians, the traditional owners of this land that we live on. Public discourse and mainstream news media present a horribly biased and inaccurate picture of the real issues that First Nations communities are facing. The only way for us to educate ourselves about what is happening and what needs to be done is to look for information outside the skewed mainstream. This means follow Indigenous writers and activists and journalists on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, go to protests. Educate yourselves about the history of Australia from non-white sources and contribute to advocacy groups like Black Rainbow and Healing Hands, and just be aware that the information given to us in textbooks, government sources, our own social media bubbles, it's not always the full picture. As a South Asian woman, I'm calling on all my fellow brown folk, the Indians, Pakistanis, Nepalis, Bangladeshis, Sri Lankans. Please, we will never be rid of racism against ourselves if we cannot help end racism against everyone everywhere. The only way that society can be equitable is if me and you put in the effort to listen, understand, and support those who are fighting for change. Now on to today's episode. There is so much to process about the way COVID has changed humanity and exposed humongous cracks in our political and social systems, in our public discourse, in our news media. I suspect that this pandemic is going to be a base note in many podcast episodes to come. So this episode, I'm talking to Tim Losodo, the founder and national director of Democracy in Colour. Democracy in Colour is an Australian advocacy group for racial and economic justice, and they campaign to end systemic racism. It's led by people of colour. These past few months, Tim and his team have been working to expose how COVID has disproportionately affected people of colour, immigrants, temporary visa holders, and marginalised sections of society. So this conversation is about Tim's work in this regard. I'm not going to summarize it here because it is a very interesting and dense conversation. And Tim, as the expert, says everything there is to say. But I will say that please listen to it because it is a very important conversation. P.S. On a completely different mic setup, I'm just hopping in to let you know that this episode was recorded in June. And since then, things have changed a little bit in Victoria with regard to the COVID situation. So just keep that in mind. Also, it was recorded on Skype. So predictably, the sound quality is rather crap.
but I hope you'll enjoy it nevertheless.
This podcast is recorded on Wurundjeri land. This is Amrita, and you're listening to Heckin' Concerned Podcast.
Hi, Tim, and welcome to Heckin' Concerned Podcast.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's really exciting to have you, and it's I'm honored that I could get a hold of you. You're a very busy man.
No. We're all, you know, just doing our best. To become a cliche to say unprecedented times, but it seems like we are in those times, and it's all requiring us to do our bit.
It is a cliche, but what else can you say? The times keep evolving. Every day, every week is different from the last in terms of what's happening in the world.
I can't remember who said it, but, you know, something about there are decades where nothing happens, and then there are like weeks where decades happen, and it feels like
that's very
we're in one of those moments.
It does feel like that.
And if nothing else, this just goes to show us that, business as usual, the status quo is not working, or rather it is working as it was built to, but how it was built to work doesn't serve the vast majority of people. In fact, it exploits our bodies, our aspirations, our dignity at the perpetual expense, just to serve the interests of a billionaire class that doesn't care about us. So that should just be further evidence that we need to facilitate, structural and systemic change and get into that.
Well, absolutely. I think the Australian government, the recent government, has a history of telling us that our needs, our emotional needs, our physical needs, our fight for justice is not as important as business as usual. All the way from the Prime Minister scolding children for participating in climate marches or for caring about the Safe Schools program. Or even now we've got Matthias Cormann threatening to take away the job seeker payments for people that participate in Black Lives Matter rallies in Australia.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, the modus operandi of this government is ridiculousness, it's hypocrisy, it's double standards, it's racism, it's a whole bunch of different things. So nothing super surprising from them.
If nothing else, we live in a country where we cannot actually be in any way persecuted for speaking out against our government. So
that's subtle persecution.
Yes.
What you just mentioned was an example of, a form of persecution for speaking out on what people believe in. This idea that you can criminalize poverty, that if you decided to attend a Black Lives Matter, protest, you could be at risk, or you could be threatened with having your safety net stripped from you. That is definitely a form of, criminalizing free speech and criminalizing political expression. The right to come together in groups to agitate. So we might not see it as explicitly as in some more authoritarian states, but it's certainly here a little bit more, under the hood.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that you say it, it's so clear how government's priorities really show the kind of freedoms that people actually really enjoy, and that's what Australia is discovering, is that a big section of the population doesn't really enjoy the freedoms that many others take for granted.
Yes, yeah, definitely, that's right.
I've been feeling quite sad to read how during the COVID-19 situation, a lot of Indigenous communities are having a real cash flow problem. First of all, tourism and art sales have dwindled, and that has really affected the income of some people. But also things like, for example, in some communities, there's a cashless debit card that is used.
Yes.
It's becoming really hard because they can't withdraw cash on it. And at the same time, stimulus payments or government support is getting blocked up. And things like that. And the COVID-19 situation has exposed really harshly the racial and socioeconomic inequalities in the world and in Australia, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, well, I think it's important to recognize that COVID-19 hasn't necessarily created inequalities. It's, as you said, the virus has exposed pre-existing injustices in society, and it's exacerbated those pre-existing injustices. And there's a whole variety of different ways in which it's done that. You know, you can start with the racialized narrative around coronavirus back before this was considered, you know, a pandemic globally and treated seriously in Australia back in January this year and even late last year. We had people exploiting what was a public health issue at the time to justify the racist beliefs they've always had. You know, we had a whole narrative that vilified all Asians as a disease risk. There were calls to ban Chinese immigration, you know, blaming Chinese people for the virus. There were hoax health alerts in Queensland advising people to avoid suburbs that had high Chinese populations. We had two major newspapers early this year label coronavirus as the Chinese virus.
Mm.
And you know, like that's not something that COVID-19 created. Again, no. It's just something that it exposed and exacerbated, that Australia has a very long history of xenophobia. That one of the first pieces passed post-Federation, what we now know as the White Australia policy, was explicitly designed to prevent Chinese migration. And 100 years later, we have this feverish discourse that invokes fear of anything Chinese, whether that be immigration, technology, or property ownership. And that's resulted in a huge spike in racial violence. You know, words mean things, and racist framing enables racism. And we've seen a spike in racial abuse online, in the streets, in public transport, and shopping centres, and workplaces all over the place. And so that's, you know, one example, the racialized narrative. There's other examples. You know, you think about migrant workers in this country is a good example, that migrant workers do some of the most dangerous and low paid work in this country. They earn poverty wages. They work under exploitative conditions. They aren't offered workplace benefits, or don't have health care, paid sick leave, or income support. And so they're more likely to be forced to work if they're sick, because they have depressed wages and they can't afford to physically distance if you can't pay the rent or you can't put food on the table. But not only that, they also have a high risk of exposure to the virus because of the industries they work in and also because of the sort of living situations they're in.
Absolutely. A lot of them live in tenement-like conditions, don't they, in cramped conditions. A lot of them are doing, as you said, work that like delivery or transportation-based work that puts them in contact with more people, and a lot of them do work that others in Australia don't like doing because it's high risk.
That's right. And so I think there's a lot of hypocrisy around how they've been treated. You know, they do frontline work that keeps this country running, whether that's you know, health, age, childcare services, whether it's cleaning, you know, domestic or commercial cleaning, whether it's hospitality, whether it's you know, picking and packing the food we eat, cleaning our spaces, construction, care services. And yet they've been cruelly excluded from the government's COVID support. There are more than 1.1 million, you know, temporary visa holders, international students, undocumented migrant workers and people seeking asylum that have been excluded from JobKeeper. And so whilst this country has been happy to build a migration system that has been reliant on the exploitation of an impoverished underclass of migrant workers over the past few decades, as soon as we hit a crisis, and it's time for this country to show a little bit of solidarity and to pay back these workers, we wash our hands of them and we treat them as if they don't exist. You know, the education, our education industry in this country, the university sector in this country would not exist without international students.
Absolutely. They rely on international students to make all their money.
That's right.
Tourism and hospitality industries rely on international students to function.
That's right. To work in heavily exploited jobs that pay often way below the minimum wage, and yet they have been excluded from JobKeeper. So this is just another example of a pre-existing inequality that has been exposed and exacerbated by COVID-19. How our government, you know, who our government views as quote unquote Australian, as a citizen, as worthy of support, has been exposed and exacerbated by this crisis.
Yeah. For example, a lot of international students accept cash in hand payments for the jobs that they do. That's a form of exploitation. But once again, the onus of finding better work or doing different kinds of work is placed on them rather than on the employers who take advantage of temporary visa holders and international students. And this idea that when they come to Australia, they're expected to be able to provide for themselves. It's this sort of rhetoric just, you know, this is reinforced when they make demands for support from the government. And yet they're welcomed with and their exploitation is allowed so happily in other times when there's no other crisis happening. It's really unfair.
It's hypocrisy that this country is happy to build a vast amount of its wealth off the backs of the labour, the exploited labour of people of colour, of migrant workers. And yet when a global pandemic hits, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime global pandemic hits, this country won't provide even the most basic support, the federal government at least. The state governments and some local governments have been stepping up, but the federal government at least won't even provide the most basic support to these folks. And the whole narrative around it, you know, again, goes back to, exposes a broader problem with the, you know, economic system, that value is assigned and associated to your economic output, that you're only worthy of support insofar that you contribute economically. And again, that's sort of another thing that's been exposed. We can talk about racialized policing. That's another thing that's been exposed by COVID-19, not created. It's just been exposed and exacerbated. You know, we've had physical distancing measures that have no doubt saved lives, but so that have sometimes been applied in a discriminatory manner. There's a disproportionate number of fines have been issued in areas largely populated by Aboriginal people and migrants. There was analysis of New South Wales fines, which I think is the only state that has sort of public data around this, by the Saturday paper in April, that found fines were predominantly issued in Western Sydney, which is an area of Sydney that is a high community of colour population. Now, 15% of all fines were in just three local government areas, Liverpool, Canterbury, Bankstown and Fairfield, high migrant areas. And those areas just represented just 5% of recorded COVID cases. So you've got 15% of all fines in areas that represented 5% of recorded COVID cases. And you compare that to local government areas around Bondi Beach, so very affluent area, predominantly white, which recorded 15% of New South Wales cases, but had only 1.8% of infringements. So there's a huge discrepancy there. And again, you know, it's not something new. Racialized policing has been a hallmark of policing in this country, like policing everywhere, really. But again, it's just another example of how COVID-19 is exposing, you know, these pre-existing inequalities.
If we talk about economic value, as you were saying before, so, for example, there's a very large investment in Melbourne CBD, a development from Chinese investors, real estate. And at that time, that investment is welcome because it contributes to the economic growth of the city. And yet people, Chinese people, or even people from across Asia were targeted in these horrible racist attacks by public media and by people. And there was such little action taken by the government to safeguard their dignity, their safety. So money is welcome.
That's right.
As long as they're bringing in money, that's okay. But don't care about them otherwise.
Yeah, that's right. Again, it's just exposed the underlying sort of, you know, driving motive of our economic system, that you only have value in our society when you're contributing economically. You know, when your value is tied and associated to your ability to produce capital. And that's it.
So before we move on, I'm curious about something. So I want to ask you, how did you come to establish democracy in colour?
Well, Democracy in Colour is a racial and economic justice organisation led by people of colour. We do two main things. We do political advocacy around economic fairness and anti-racism. And the second thing we do is a lot of leadership and training programs designed to strengthen the political voice of people of colour. So we're a startup. We were started just over 2 years ago. And we were started to address three gaps that we saw in the anti-racism space. The first one being that, you know, most work that happens in the anti-racism space right now is education, welfare, based work, and that's very important. But we saw a big gap in terms of political advocacy. We wanted to create a new organisation that contested power in the political arena on behalf of communities of colour. The second gap was that, you know, this space is very white. Ironically, you know, the anti-racism space, as is symptomatic of the broader NGO space, is dominated by white-led organisations or even entirely white-comprised organisations. And we thought it was important that a new racial justice organisation that was actually led by people who experience racial justice, that organisation was started. And the third gap we identified was that we saw a real need for more work that tackled racism from a structural perspective. And we're an explicitly anti-capitalist organisation because our analysis around racism very much lies within this idea that we operate within a broken economic system that relies on weaponising race and weaponising racism to get working people to point the finger of blame at each other, to shout at each other, so that we're not shouting at the broken rules that screw us all over, that exploit our bodies, our dignity, our aspirations for the benefit of a billionaire class.
So everyone is waking up to the fact that capitalism is quite broken the way it's functioning in a large part of the world right now. Do you think that democracy, do you personally think that democracy and capitalism need each other?
Oh, no, definitely not. I think capitalism perverts democracy. I think, look, democracy is fundamentally, you know, the promise of democracy is that inequality of resource can be breached by equality of voice, this idea that everybody has the same voice. And that is not the case here in Australia, and it's certainly not the case, taken to an extreme in the US, where money is seen as free speech. And, you know, it's not the case here because we have the perversion of democracy by money in politics, by big business, by lobbyists who walk the halls of Canberra or Spring Street or wherever. I think the two are actually quite incompatible because we've got one, that's enables access to decision makers. In fact, not just enables access to decision makers, enables you to become a decision maker based off how much money you have, your access to resources. You know, you look at the fossil fuel lobby and the revolving door between, you know, not just advisors in senior parliamentary offices and senior ministerial offices who then go back into the fossil fuel industry and then vice versa, but actual politicians who go back into the fossil fuel industry shortly after retiring from public office. Democracy is not going to survive under capitalism. It's not a matter of like whether they need each other. They definitely don't, but actually they're quite incompatible.
Mm. Well, I was going to build up to this question because this is a big question, but we're there already. So what is a new kind of economic system that is good that you'd like to see?
Sure. Look, I think, our current system, I think we live in a system where growth is the sole commandment, right? It's a system that treats us all like property, that turns us into profit and loss calculators, that sees us as numbers on somebody's spreadsheet. It's a system that fundamentally brutalizes, humiliates, dehumanizes people. And fundamentally, it's a system that prioritizes accumulation of profit over everything, over life itself. And I think we're seeing, COVID is a sort of great, terrible example of this in action, where our economic system is willing to sacrifice life in the interests of profit. This whole idea of not going into lockdown, of trying to delay lockdown as much as possible, when we know that that's what's required to save lives and to stem the spread of this pandemic. There were people and commentators, not necessarily, you know, that narrative thankfully wasn't so embedded here, but definitely in the US. There were people and commentators there saying, you know, it was okay for people to die. Basically, you know, making this argument that there's such thing as an acceptable number of deaths. And we can see that quite clearly in analysis. You know, there was analysis done by Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the head of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and one of the main folks on Trump's coronavirus task force. And then according to analysis that he did, had mitigation guidelines been put into effect in the U.S. just 1 week earlier, so in March 9 instead of March 16, 60% of U.S. COVID-19 deaths would have been prevented. So we're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of people who would still be alive if the narrative in the U.S. Wasn't focused around, you know, how, you know, this, protecting the stocks or protecting, you know, the interests of millionaires and billionaires or big mega corporations, but was actually about protecting life.
Mm.
The current pandemic has exposed this idea that capitalism is fundamentally just about profit over everything, including life itself.
Mm.
And we didn't really need, you know, COVID-19 to tell us that. You know, you look at our planet, right? We're tearing our planet apart. There have been, you know, 5 major extinction level events of species in recorded fossil history. We're in the 6th now, and it's not coming from some asteroid or, you know, some natural phenomena. It's coming from us.
From us, humans. Yeah. We're
driving extinction levels to a height not seen in 66 million years. We're driving ourselves to the precipice of climate catastrophe. Inequality is spiraling out of control. You know, like we were sort of saying earlier, that the only way a system like this survives, one that fundamentally screws over the majority of people for the benefit of a tiny minority, is by manipulating, dividing those people, by weaponizing race.
Mm.
So to answer your original question around what does an ideal world or an ideal economy look like, I think it's one that's not those things. I mean, you know, we can have a conversation around what an ideal economy looks like until the cows come home, and you know, lots of people would have many great ideas around that. But there's one fundamental, you know, and I'm not going to profess that I have all of those ideas, but the fundamental fact is that business as usual can't continue, that it's broken. Our system is broken. That's an incontrovertible fact. And I think an ideal economy to me is one where, you know, the things you need to live a meaningful life are afforded to everybody, that everybody has access to universal education, that everybody has access to housing, that everybody has access to clean, affordable energy, that everybody has access to a well-paid, unionized, meaningful job, that you know, people live lives of purpose, that they you know, don't feel like they have to enslave themselves to a 9-to-5, you know, 40, 50, 60-hour job that they hate, just to live, you know, just to survive, just to pay rent and put.
Well, I guess if the progress of a country is judged by growth, as you pointed out before, we're just obsessively growth focused, economic growth, then other parameters of health are not taken into account. As you said, well-being, emotional well-being, spiritual well-being, I mean, even basic physical well-being and housing. Does everybody have a safe place in which they can be? You know, so
that's right.
It's actually today I got an email from the Victorian Chamber of Commerce saying we're trying to put pressure on Premier Daniel Andrews of Victoria to start open up the economy again and not delay it, because the business, you know, the business industry will suffer, the economy will suffer. There's so much obsession around the economy. It's almost as though we are for the economy rather than the economy being for us. It's actually not, the economy is not a real thing. The economy is us. And we are living creatures who have other needs other than just making money or exchanging and engaging in commercial activity.
That's right.
And that's exactly what COVID, or even the mental health crisis, as you said, how could we be happy as people if we are constantly in a race towards growth. Because obviously our personal micro models of achievement or career or growth also reflect the macro environment of constant, like increasing wealth, increasing assets, increasing production, constantly increasing. So if you can earn a million, then you should earn 5 million, you know, or, you know, it, and the higher up the social, the economic ranks you are, the bigger your leaps are. Whereas, you know, the people that are not well off, really for them, the leaps are so tiny into, it could even just be affording to buy food every night is, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we really need to, we just need to go back to basics, right? What are the first principles of life, really? You know, this idea of what are the, what, why are we here? You know, what is the purpose of living? And it is not to earn a 100K or 150K, you know, job. It's not to like have a house and two cars and it. Like we need to have a conversation, a national conversation, a global conversation really around what is the purpose of life? Like what does it mean to live a meaningful life? And I think we would come to answers that are so vastly and wildly disconnected from our current reality that it wouldn't, you know, necessitate such a huge rethink. You think about like work, you know, this the idea of work. Our time is not our own. We need to radically reduce our working week. You know, this idea that the global economy produces 10 times more per person than it did in 1930. And there were all of these popular ideas, you know, from economists like Keynes and, you know, even the Flintstones, right? It's in popular culture that the advancement of technology would result in radically reduced working weeks.
No, you know, in like fact, it's just made it worse.
Right, like 8 hour, you know, what were like 8 hour, 16 hour working weeks. And yes, it has made it worse. And it's like, we deserve to have our time liberated to create space for taking care of each other, for building a better social fabric and spending time on the creative pursuits that actually make us human, to spend time on the things that make us feel the most human. We don't have that at the moment.
Is there a big push in Australia from groups to get a four-day work week going like there is in some parts of the world?
I think Prime Minister Ardern's you know, recent push or idea at least.
Instituting
a four-day working week as a way of bouncing back from COVID-19 in New Zealand has started to catalyse a similar conversation in Australia. But frankly, we lack the political leadership on both sides of the political spectrum in the AOP for a long time.
Well, if the government is not doing anything about it, can individuals and corporations and even small businesses, what can people do to ensure that come September, when the JobKeeper payments stop, what can they do to ensure that people are not suddenly falling off a cliff? For example, there's this fear that people are being kept on as long as there's a government wage subsidy. The minute that stops, people will be laid off. So we're looking at another big issue a few months down the line. What sort of responsibilities do companies have towards their workers, and what can they do to ensure a better balance of work and life?
Well, look, it's going to be a disaster because not only will JobKeeper end, the coronavirus supplement that pushed JobSeeker, what is now known as JobSeeker, above poverty lines for the first time in decades, will also be cut. And so you'll have a whole bunch of people who will no longer be on JobKeeper. Well, JobKeeper won't be a thing, and so you'll have a whole bunch of people who will now be unemployed, and they will be going on to JobSeeker. But you'll also have JobSeeker that will be cut to below poverty levels. So you've got this double whammy. And then you've got a whole bunch of people right now and who have been for months who aren't on JobKeeper, who aren't able to access either JobKeeper or JobSeeker, the 1.1 million people we were talking about before, these temporary visa holders, these international students, these undocumented workers, these people seeking asylum who have been, you know, relegated to destitution and poverty and starvation. We have got a crisis on our hands right now, and it's just going to be exacerbated come September if JobKeeper is wound back and if JobSeeker is not kept at its current level. So, look, what we've got to do is not wait until then. We've got to ramp up the advocacy right now to ensure that the government doesn't do these things. And if they do them, we hold them accountable for pushing hundreds of thousands of more people into poverty and hold them accountable for that. wide scale, industrial scale abuse of people.
Mm. So
economic
abuse
of people.
How is democracy in color? What are you specifically doing with regard to this issue?
Well, definitely. All of our campaigning work has pivoted to responding to COVID and supporting marginalized communities of color through this. We're doing a lot of work right now around fighting for a wage subsidy for all alongside dozens of other community organizations and unions to ensure that every person in this country, including the 1.1 million temporary visa workers, has access to life-saving, critical economic support through this crisis. And we've had a few wins across the country with various state governments instituting different economic packages to support those who have been excluded from federal government assistance. And we've also been focusing on local councils to encourage them to set up both financial and in-kind programs to support, again, people who have been excluded from federal packages. And we've had a number of wins in that space too. The other big advocacy focus for us has been around establishing an information firewall between health professionals and the Department of Home Affairs to ensure that, you know, at the moment, if you're an undocumented migrant worker and if you turned up to a hospital to get checked for COVID-19 or because you're exhibiting symptoms, you are at risk of having your visa checked and then potentially being detained and or deported. And so that obviously creates a positive disincentive for people in those situations to get themselves checked. So
absolutely.
One that is like a rights issue, because fundamentally healthcare should be universal and everybody, especially in a global pandemic, should have access to healthcare. But two, it's also just like a public health issue that in the case of a global pandemic, you don't want 100,000 people, which is roughly how many undocumented workers there are. You don't want 100,000 people hiding themselves away when they should be presenting themselves at a hospital if they've got if they're exhibiting symptoms. And, you know, this has been the driver behind many of the second waves that we've seen in other countries. You take Singapore, for example, that
yep.
at one point in time was the paragon, you know, this shining light in the Asia Pacific around its response to coronavirus. And it's, you know, now in the midst of a terrible
second wave
that's made it a hotspot. And that's because of how it treated its migrant workers. And we're doing the exact same thing to our migrant workers as well. So it's a huge risk.
The listeners of this podcast are largely 60% women between the ages of 25 and 38. My listeners are very interested in the issues that we're discussing. So what can they do now that the severe racial inequality in Australia is becoming so apparent that it's plastered on every headline? What can they do to advocate for themselves and for more equality?
Yeah, well, firstly, Democracy in Colour is you know, a small cog in a broader social change wheel. And there have been dozens of fantastic, you know, community organisations and unions that have really stepped up in the lack of federal leadership to fight for communities that have been left out and to fight for, you know, a people-centred response to COVID-19 and also a people-centered recovery. And so I think it's like really important that when we talk about, you know, when we're in the after times and we're looking back on this moment and when this moment is no longer the current moment but it becomes a, you know, piece of history that we talk about and reflect on and analyze, you know, we don't let this idea that of you know, the federal government, it was them that you know, led us out of this response. It was civil society and local communities that led us out of this. You know, the all of the mutual aid groups and small communities in informal groups, not organized, you know, in any particular way, stepping up because they saw their neighbor in need and they knew, you know, that their values compelled them to do something about that. That was the leadership that got us through this crisis. Nothing that, you know, Morrison did. So I don't know, that's the first thing. I think the second thing is like, you know, to answer your question is this idea that democracy is not a spectator sport. And you know, we go back to this idea that that democracy, the promise of democracy anyway, is that inequality of resources can be breached by equality of voice. But right now that's been perverted. And we have the power of civil society and the power of communities disproportionately dwarfed by the power of big business and the power of lobbyists and the power of, you know, billionaires and millionaires. And so the only way we can counteract that power imbalance is by organizing. You know, we need to do with people what the other side does with money. Everybody who's listening to this needs to get involved, and, you know, get involved however you want to, whether that's in, you know, your local community organization, whether it's a service delivery organization, it's a political advocacy organization, whatever, on whatever issue that you care about, just get involved, because democracy doesn't function without you.
That's really useful. Thank you. I think a lot of us don't realize that we are important in our democracy. We don't think about it actively. But,
well, and that's because we've, been told this narrative since birth that, politics is not for you, mm-hmm. that it's not for everyday people. It's for this specific political and economic elite that studies law, you know, that works for politicians. You know, this is part of this particular class. And that's a narrative that only serves that particular class, because when you're disenfranchised, when you think that, you know, your voice doesn't matter, that nothing you do will matter or make any difference, and so you're not going to do anything at all, that only serves the status quo. That only serves our political and economic elite, because they get to make decisions. You know, decisions are still being made. They're just being made without you. We need to get real about self-educating ourselves around how our systems really operate, how our broken structures really operate, who they serve and who they crush. Which communities our systems crush in order to serve this vested special interest. And then we need to commit ourselves to doing something about it, because social change is not inevitable. The only way things change is if we get involved.
Yeah, and social change is not something that somebody else can just keep fighting for without us participating in it.
That's right. Yeah. You know, there is no other person, right? Yeah. It's you.
It's us. That's democracy. Your passion, your intelligence, your zeal and your drive is really inspirational. Thank you so much thank you so much for doing the good work that you do. Thanks for coming and talking to me about all of these issues. It's paramount importance right now.
Oh, thanks for having me. And I'm really looking forward to working with everyone. And, you know, if you're involved in social change right now and you're listening to this, keep up the great work. And if you're not, there's no better time than the present to get involved right now.
So they can come and look up the work of Democracy in Colour at democracyincolour.org.
That's right.
.au? Yes.
Oh, no, it's just democracyincolour.org.
Cool.
But, you know, it doesn't have to be Democracy in Colour. There's a whole bunch of great organisations out there on a whole variety of different issues. The point is to get involved in whatever thing you care about.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Tim.
Great. Thank you.